I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 27th of June. The Supreme Court today struck down a pair of Texas abortion laws that would have shut down dozens of clinics in the state, and the ruling has national implications. We this hour will have more on the Brexit vote. Angela Merkel's chief of staff said politicians in London should have the possibility to think again about the fallout from an exit, but France is arguing the longer the uncertainty, the greater the financial and economic pain will be for the rest of Europe and for the UK. Some interesting polls over the weekend. NBC Wall Street Journal shows Hillary Clinton leading Donald Trump by 5 points. The Washington Post ABC poll has her up 51% to 39%, but this may be a year we don't put a whole lot of faith in polls. I don't know. Half of Americans are anxious about a Clinton presidency, and 2 in 3 Americans feel Donald Trump is unqualified to be president. Bernie Sanders supporters upset by the results of a 9-hour Democratic platform meeting on Friday. The committee voted down a number of issues that Sanders had highlighted in his campaign, the $15 an hour minimum wage, fracking, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a carbon tax, and single-payer health care. Should we expect any action on a ban on assault weapons and universal background checks after the Orlando massacre and last week's House sit-in? Those are a few of the topics we'll be discussing this hour, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. First, let me tell you about our guest. She is Margaret Tolliv, the senior White House correspondent at Bloomberg. She's a board member of the White House Correspondents Association, president of the Washington Press Club Foundation. She previously served as White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers and also has been a reporter at the Los Angeles Times and the Tampa Tribune. Margaret, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks. It's my pleasure.
Well, we're getting a lot of rulings from the Supreme Court in the last few days. If you would like to start with today's, would you say that it really is, as many press accounts have said, the most significant abortion decision in many a year?
It is, because it's really the first time that the court has centrally tackled it in about a decade, close to a decade now. And, you know, because the ruling itself sort of talked about creating an undue burden on women's constitutional right to an abortion, it suggests that the court, at least as it's currently constructed, still believes that women have a constitutional right to this, in terms of health and reproductive rights issues. And so, this all exists sort of in a political context, of course, also with the 2016 elections. Hillary Clinton and the Democrats have talked a lot about the importance of filling the vacancy that exists now on the court and any upcoming vacancies with people who will substantiate, among other things, women's reproductive health rights. And this, on the one hand, gives a sense that maybe there isn't that urgency that they've been suggesting there is. Maybe gives Democrats a little bit of breathing room in terms of that. But also, you can just see both sides of the political spectrum on any time that the court rules on anything with any significance like that, just sort of gearing up to draw the parameters of the battle lines over any replacement campaign for justice.
And what's the latest, Margaret, on getting the ninth justice?
It always has, and it may still depend a little bit on what happens in the fall. And the Republicans who now control Congress have a decision to make about whether their prospects are better of going if they go with this consensus pick that not a consensus pick, but more of a consensus pick that President Obama has set forth, or whether to roll the dice and wait until after the election. If Clinton were to win the election, it's hard to imagine her picking anyone more conservative. And so it really is a calculation about whether to kind of go with what's been the longstanding standard, which is the president has a right to name some pre-court nominees. And they tend to be like, this is something that in years past, this is the sort of candidate that probably could have gotten through. And so you know, it may really come down to either November and what happens in that space during the lame duck Congress or in the lead up to November, depending on how the polling looks around, you know, Labor Day weekend. That also could have some impact on the timing of this.
And the abortion ruling today really has national implications, doesn't it?
Well, certainly it does. I mean, look, anytime the Supreme Court takes something up, by that time it already has national implications well beyond what happens in Texas. But what the advocates for abortion rights have said is that it's already very difficult in many states, you know, to get an abortion. This would have made it, you know, would have substantiated states that are so inclined to make it more and more difficult by applying these sort of hospital-like standards for surgery and admitting privilege at local hospitals and all this sort of thing. So it absolutely does. Now, it also, in a purely political sense, may take some of the heat out of the, you know, this is an issue that Democrats have used to rally their base, to rally campaign contributions, to get younger women engaged in the process and voting. And to the extent that it sort of dampens, you know, the urgency on those issues, that may actually work to dampen younger or female Democratic enthusiasm or turnout. But in general, if your issue is protecting existing abortion rights, today's ruling is something that you would hail.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about polls and then maybe dismiss polls, except what's behind the polls is interesting. Washington Post ABC shows Hillary Clinton ahead 51-39. The NBC Wall Street Journal showing she has a 5-point lead. But what I found interesting in the Post survey, half of all Americans are anxious about a Clinton presidency and 2 in 3 Americans feel Donald Trump is unqualified to be president.
You can feel great about all of these results. I mean, number one, anything that looks remotely like a 10-point lead, and that doesn't seem like a fluke is a problem for the person on the losing end of that margin. So this is, you know, this sort of the trend. These are not results that Donald Trump can feel good about. But it shows, again, that this race is kind of all relative, right? It's that there is not much of the enthusiasm inside the Democratic Party for Hillary Clinton up until now has been enthusiasm to have a Democrat in office rather than the Republican alternative, and particularly when that alternative has been Donald Trump. And that's what this suggests. And you've begun to see her running that way, right? Mm-hmm. That what she's doing in these now general election speeches is spending a lot of time not only criticizing Donald Trump, but kind of going point by point through areas of weakness, whether it's contradictions in his arguments or, you know, he says he wants to support American business, but he's having stuff manufactured in other countries, things he said about women. None of these things are like, you know, things you can embrace about Hillary Clinton. These are all things that you want to run away from Donald Trump on. And that's, these polls sort of underscore why she's doing that, because if there's anyone who's less popular than her, it's him, right? So, but it is sort of it's a negative way to run, and it's a negative atmosphere.
Yeah, sure is. Well, he didn't do himself any favors when he was in Scotland talking about how he believed in the Leave vote, and it was a sign that this country is taking itself back. Scotland didn't vote that way at all.
Right. They were going the other way.
I know. It showed a complete lack of understanding.
Because she's been Secretary of State, and because, of course, she was in the Senate and had some experience there with foreign policy issues, on the one hand, there's some liabilities. You can talk about her record, whether it was, you know, what she supported doing in Libya or Syria or what have you. But on the other hand, nobody would argue that she is experienced in foreign policy issues. And in fact, when you look at polling, like, she rates pretty highly on that in terms of experience. And so for her, one challenge has been how much does she emphasize her foreign policy skills, both because the economy is really what's more likely to drive people to turn out. And the way she seems to be threading the needle is to just kind of say, well, it's a given that I have foreign policy skills. Let's talk about what's wrong with Donald Trump's you know, foreign policy experience or lack thereof. Yep. And it's been really interesting. You don't really see her talking that much or as much as she could be about, I know what I'm talking about. This is what I think because of all the experience that I've had. It's like, yes, I'm the former Secretary of State, and now let's return to our conversation about Donald Trump.
Exactly.
And again, you see why in this case. But what I think was tremendously interesting to watch was today with Elizabeth Warren finally hitting the campaign trail for Hillary Clinton, how two things happened. Number one, the idea of a more positive and less negative message in terms of her promoting Clinton and saying you should get behind her. And number two, the two of them joining up together exactly to attack Donald Trump on just these issues that we've been talking about.
Yeah, and clearly Elizabeth Warren is a master at attacking Donald Trump. What do you think about these comments from a professor of political science at the University of Akron who said, getting back to Brexit for a moment and relating it to what's going on here, Thursday's Brexit referendum is an unnerving reminder that voter anger is deeper and broader than many elite politicians and veteran pollsters realize. It clearly is a cautionary tale for the Clinton campaign not to get too complacent with a potential victory.
Sure. I think that that's true with the caveat that it's really not a perfect parallel. I mean, the system doesn't work the same way, and the UK being part of the EU, there's not really a comparison. This is not a vote about whether the US should remove itself from multilateral decision making in some sort of way. And I also think, you know, demographically, when you look at the trends, there are to some extent some different demographic trends in play here. The U.S. has the Electoral College. Like, there are all sorts of technical and more narrative reasons why it's not a perfect analogy. But, of course, absolutely, it is a cautionary tale. If the race between Clinton and Trump should tighten to be within a margin of error. I mean, mm-hmm. in the weeks leading up to, and particularly in the days leading up to this election, you know, you can say that the polling wasn't right, but the polling wasn't, like, grotesquely, horrifically out of bounds wrong either. Everybody knew that this was close and down to the wire. If you look at where the national polls are now between Clinton and Donald Trump, it's not that. It could be that if it gets to be that. You know, if it's October and it's a four-point race, everyone will be talking about Brexit and what right. the lessons of that were for here. But right. But I think for now, the Clinton campaign has sort of duly noted this and said, wow, that happened. But the focus seems to be a lot more on, like, you know, what it's been on, Ohio and Pennsylvania and a little bit of Florida. And the focus in terms of I think the real irony with Brexit and the real concern is not necessarily that what happened there shows what Americans will do. I think it's more like this. If there are economic implications more than just a day or two or a couple of weeks that really spill into the U.S. If what happened with Brexit draws, you know, the region or the world and by extension the U.S. toward recession,
right.
is that going to be blamed on the anti-Cameron forces and kind of the Donald Trumps of the world? Or is that going to end up reflecting on Obama because he's the president of the United States and then Hillary Clinton by extension, right? Mm-hmm. If it's Clinton's fault that there's a recession or anything close to a recession or a slide of the economy, if it's perceived as her fault, even though she didn't want the Brexit, that will hurt her. If people don't connect the dots that way at all, if they see it as something that happened in Britain or particularly if they see it as something that happened that Donald Trump had advocated, right, then it could have a completely different impact. So the irony really would be if the Brexit ended up inadvertently hurting Clinton's election campaign by having a negative impact on the U.S. economy, which would be blamed on Obama and then blamed on Clinton. Mm-hmm. I mean, I see that as maybe even a more likely kind of parallel than whether British voters are foreshadowing what may happen here.
Yeah. Let's go to the Democratic Platform 9-hour meeting in Missouri on Friday. People who voted for Bernie Sanders in the primaries are upset that the DNC platform voted down some issues that were very important to those voters. $15 an hour minimum wage, fracking, proposals to support a carbon tax, single-payer health care.
Yeah.
How are you going to woo all those people and make sure that they vote for Hillary Clinton if you take all of those issues and vote them down?
I think with Elizabeth Warren, I think that might be what's happening here. I mean, part of the struggle for Bernie Sanders has always been that those pesky superdelegates who he, you know, has been campaigning against are also the people who tend to control the inner workings of the party. And the DNC chairman, who he's been trying to force out and who the Clinton campaign has said they're not going to be part of helping force out. You know, these are like, these are their rules and this is their convention. And he was not able to convince enough of them in the right mix to just kind of like redo the platform the way he wanted it or else. And today's appearance with Elizabeth Warren may represent some kind of a tipping point where there was so much enthusiasm in that Democratic crowd for her and her message. And her message, at least for now, it could be a different message next January if Clinton's president and Elizabeth Warren's, you know, in the Senate raising hell about the appointee she doesn't like or policy she doesn't like. But between now and November, Elizabeth Warren making more than 100% clear that she is going to be campaigning for Clinton, behind Clinton. She wants everybody else to get on board. And it was just striking not to see Sanders there today and to see Warren there in his place. And it was always, before there was Bernie Sanders, it was always Elizabeth Warren that the most of the people who became Bernie Sanders supporters wanted. Mm-hmm. To see her ascend to that stage, not as the nominee, not as a presumptive nominee, but as a full-throated champion, again, for now, of Hillary Clinton, I think says a lot about how the Clinton campaign sees their best path to uniting Democrats behind her.
Is Warren the VP pick for Clinton, do you think, Margaret?
Well, I think most people who follow this sort of stuff still think that it's not the most, that she's not the most likely pick, but everybody who I talk to say that she has gotten a lot more serious consideration than they would have thought that she would have to begin with. But there still remain some of these issues. One of them is the country ready for a double female ticket? Number two, you know, do you want to take a powerful Democrat out of the Senate right when you're on the cusp of potentially being able to take back control of the Senate? Three is, what's the relationship between these two women? Do they have a good rapport? And could Clinton trust Warren, A, not to upstage her in office, B, to be loyal the way you need to be if you're the vice president? And if Joe Biden is the model for this, in terms of his relationship with Obama, if that's what Hillary Clinton is looking for, is there any way that Elizabeth Warren, given her personality, given her base of support, given her her relative longevity in the party and what she hopes to accomplish in the years ahead, is there any way that she could be, you know, that person? And so I think that most folks I talk to around the campaign still think that she's not the most likely pick, but folks have said pretty consistently that it's not just sort of being said for effect, that it's actually she actually has been being considered seriously by Clinton and her folks.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have other issues on the table. We'll get to them. Margaret Tolliv is our guest. She is the senior White House correspondent at Bloomberg. She's covering the White House and the 2016 presidential campaign. She is also president of the Washington Press Club Foundation. We'll have to talk about Donald Trump excluding various broadcast outlets and print outlets from campaign events. We'll also have to talk about CNN taking on Corey Lewandowski, and I guess it created quite an upheaval among the staff at CNN. We'll talk about that. She probably has some inside knowledge, considering her involvement with the White House Correspondents Association. And we'll be welcoming your phone calls. Here's our phone number. Lines are open for you right now for all things political, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. I am Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's All Things Political, 800-486-8655. We had a great show on the Brexit vote last week. What do you think of the outcome? What do you think of the impact it will have, if any, on the American elections? Does it say something that voters are mad, not just in the UK, but they're mad also in America, and it would behoove the Clinton campaign to look closely at what that vote is all about? We're talking about the polls that are out recently that show that Hillary Clinton has a substantial lead in one of them and 5-point lead in another, but really a lot of dissatisfaction with both candidates. It makes it an amazing race. Also, today's Supreme Court rulings and whatever else you'd like to discuss. Our number is 800-486-8655, and lines are open for you right now. We start with Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi. It's so easy to focus on Trump and all his negatives. I wish we'd spend as much time looking at how bad Hillary actually is. I'm on the left. I'm way on the left. I'm a union member for the last 16 years. I voted for Obama twice. Very disappointed in that man. Senator Hillary Clinton voted for the Iraq War, which basically started the whole Middle East unraveling. And as Secretary of State, her reset with Russia, Benghazi, Egypt, Libya, Syria, all of that has come back to haunt us now. The dead Americans, the dead people in the Middle East, millions probably dead and displaced over there. And now Elizabeth Warren is wrapping her arms around Hillary, who was basically Wall Street's favorite person in the big banks. This is just all stunning. And Bernie Sanders, the way he was just treated by getting not a single one of his ideas through the Democratic platform. I'm voting green this year, but I'm praying that we actually have a third alternative that hasn't arrived on the scene yet, somebody that people, average Americans, can get behind, because what we just saw happen in England, if we did have the popular vote here, I absolutely believe a third choice, a good third choice, could easily beat both of these fools.
And who's the good third choice, Ray?
I don't know, but I know there is a person like Glenn Allen from Milwaukee who runs Growing Power, somebody who is really from the grassroots and is not establishment. Hillary is pure establishment. Oh, yeah, one more thing.
All right.
So was for this new Pacific trade deal, which once Bernie Sanders started talking about it, she kind of flip-flopped. Well, I don't believe anything that comes out of her mouth, much less Donald Trump. We really, really, really are in trouble this year. I don't care what anybody says. This is very bad.
All right, Ray, thanks for the call. Margaret.
Hillary Clinton does need to worry about this. She needs to worry about voters like Ray. And I don't know if Ray's still on the line or not, but I would be interested to know if Sanders had come out on stage today with Elizabeth Warren, or if Sanders at some point during the convention, when he gives the speech that he's widely expected to be asked to give, you know, if he does anything close to a full-throated embrace of Hillary Clinton, whether that will make a difference or not. I think every voter has the right to, you know, stay home if that's the message that they want to send, or to vote for anybody they want to. But of course, you do so knowing that you're not... That third person who hasn't yet been identified is probably not going to be the next president of the United States. So to the extent that she has really that sort of lingering dissatisfaction from people who are not satisfied with Elizabeth Warren's embrace, or maybe would not be satisfied with Bernie Sanders' embrace of Clinton, that could be a problem for her. It really could.
Well, it does make you wonder, when you've got two-thirds of the people thinking the Republican candidate is unfit to be president, half very anxious about Hillary Clinton, that we've got the wrong people who are running for president, right? What happened?
I think some of what may be happening also is just that it's like a broader societal issue that has less to do with these specific candidates, although the polling certainly shows these specific candidates are not, like, they don't bring out the best in, you know, voters. But it's this sort of broader stratification where there really are only two major parties that can field nominees for president. There, in theory, exists a path, an elusive path for a, you know, self-funded billionaire, perhaps, who wanted to try to run as an independent. But even then, it's, you know, very difficult. But the way the voters in America are, people identify less and less with political parties. And if you're an independent, you know, you may be much more likely to vote for a Republican or much more likely to vote for a Democrat, but you can't, you're shut out of the primary process in many states because the primary process are party processes. And so you see, like, an evolution of society that's changing much faster than an evolution of political parties. And as a result, you have what you had in the case of a lot of Sanders fans and supporters, which is, you know, a feeling that the system is unfair. But it's not like the system just became, you know, unfair, if unfair is the word you want to use. I mean, these are the processes that have existed for a long time, and nobody thought twice about it. But in an age where it's like you can just buy a phone and then choose whichever carrier you want, you don't even need cable anymore. You can just drop cable and buy streaming services. People don't like to get, you know, kind of locked down into the whole column of choices that comes with one person or one set of ideas. And the way the party structure works, that's how it works. That's how nominees are chosen.
Right.
And to some extent, that's how presidents are chosen. And I think part of the dissatisfaction, certainly part of it is economic, part of it has to do with globalization, part of it has to do with, you know, the nature of American jobs, not being able to catch up with the global economy fast enough and all that stuff. But part of it is just something about society. It is these very rapid changes in the way we as individuals expect to be able to kind of put together a menu of our choices the way we like them. And when they are dictated by parties and rules, it runs afoul of our instincts in a way that our instincts didn't take us, 12 or 16 or 20 years ago.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Ray, for your call. What did you make of and what are you hearing? I'm sure you must know people who work for CNN, but I hear there's quite an uproar over their hiring at $500,000 a year. Corey Lewandowski.
Yeah, there's been a couple of sort of different the range of accounts about this has ranged from people are in an uproar and threatening to leave to, other coverage that says, well, people were certainly talking about it, but everybody understood what it was. And I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. But there was a lot of, it was certainly an eye-catching decision, but not only because he's a sort of provocative, controversial figure within the Trump universe, but also that it just had that feeling of hiring someone who's maybe not particularly well suited for that exact role, but getting them before another network or cable channel picked them up. And so in a way, it's a media story as much as it's a Donald Trump story or a Corey Lewandowski story. The proof is going to be in the pudding. If he surprises people once he finds his footing as an analyst and does a good, incredible job, this will fizzle as a controversy. If he if he doesn't, then it'll sort of it'll keep the controversy alive. But I'm personally not shocked at all, because the minute that a top spokesperson, analyst, strategist from any campaign becomes available, the new trend in media has been, you know, who's going to pick them up. But I think it's safe to say that some are more polarizing than others. He was a very polarizing figure, and now he's on TV. So
now he's on TV. This is America, for heaven's sake. Ed is next in West Dallas. Hi, Ed.
One of the reasons that we have these actually three candidates that basically have not talked about working class or unionized issues at all is because of the nature of our media in 2016. Your guest is employed by the biggest capitalist in the United States. He has Charlie Rose on his payroll, who never has anyone from organized labor on his PBS show, and trying to break the wall at CBS this morning to bring labor guests on is like trying to summit Everest. And this has been this concentration of media power among very corporate-dominated entities in the United States has been going on forever. We haven't had a socialist newspaper in this town in Milwaukee since 1939 with the Milwaukee Leader. We lost our labor paper here 3 years ago. And you have to accept part of the responsibility for the mess that you've created. You're in this structure too. And people view you as every bit as much of an elite. You have your round tables and the Sunday morning chat shows We can't, in organized labor, penetrate any of those. We're never invited on.
I think Margaret's just doing her job and doing it well, but let's go to the broader point here of, and there is some just criticism that there is kind of, and that's what has been said, that the press kind of missed what was going on in terms of the Sanders and Trump phenomenon exactly, because it's an insular community. Is that a valid criticism, Margaret?
I think the criticism or the controversy about whether unions and union leaders get sufficient coverage is really in many ways different than the criticism about whether Donald Trump got sort of too much free media or network coverage, or and certainly has been able on many networks and cable channels to bend the rules and appear on air at a moment's command under his terms in a different way than other candidates. So I think we should take them as separate issues. But in an organization like Bloomberg, which many of our readers, the core of our client base, are people who are in the financial industry, whether they're investors or corporate executives, we frequently write about unions and write about the views of unions. I'm just looking at our database now, and I just typed in Rich Trumka's name, of AFL-CIO, just to get a good barometer of it. And we have Trumka quoted in a dozen stories or so over the last month, including his own views about, here's the most recent headline from June 21st, the excerpts of the speech that he delivered in Atlantic City last week about Donald Trump being profoundly unfit for office, and talking about his remarks about why he feels that that's true. So I don't know. I think my news organization does cover union issues and union concerns and the union voice. I think most news organizations that are covering the presidential race actually did cover Rich Trumka's remarks about Donald Trump's candidacy.
Thanks, Ed, for the call. Marty in Douglas County. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I must say I was astonished and really pleased at the Supreme Court decisions, the abortion clinic's decision in Texas, and I'm so excited about the other one that I can't even remember what it was. the governor of Virginia, I couldn't really care less about that. What was the third one? I'm totally blanking on it.
Well, there was affirmative action, immigration, and then today's, is there another one that came up today?
There were, help. Well, anyway, we'll see what
was the financial,
don't think about it, and you'll remember.
Was it the financial services industry case?
I'm sorry, say
enforcing
that again?
Enforcing state limits on interest rates, the financial services industry case?
No, it wasn't.
Okay,
Nina Totenberg,
so maybe you borrowed a large sum of money, right?
About it. Well, whatever. There's 20 people listening to the radio screaming what it is.
All right, they'll call. Don't worry, Marty. They're on their way.
Good, thank God. and on a more fluffy note, I haven't heard any names for vice presidents for either of the major candidates. My own personal guess is one of the Castro boys will be running with Hillary Clinton. I mean the American Castros, not the Cuban Castros. Anybody floating around out there that you've heard of?
For Hillary Clinton or for
either
Donald Trump?
Either Clinton or Trump.
I mean, kind of that Clinton universe again, this is all with a caveat that it could be none of these people, right? It could be absolutely none of these people. It could be someone else who's right in front of us, somebody else you never thought of. But the kind of universe that people tend to talk about always includes Tim Kaine, the Virginia senator, the former governor, the former DNC chair. Often includes Julian Castro or Tom Perez, the labor secretary, two kind of prominent Latino or Hispanic figures. Periodically included Sherrod Brown because he's from Ohio, and also senator, and also gets the organized labor voters excited and a little bit more invested. Some other women that I hear sometimes are Amy Klobuchar or Claire McCaskill, although Elizabeth Warren still tends to be the prospective female running mate who gets that segment of the Democratic base the most excited. But she also has, as we talked about earlier, all these reasons that would offset the likelihood that she might be chosen. That's a lot of those are a lot of the universe. I mean, Cory Booker from New Jersey has been a really effective surrogate for her out on the stump, but has other issues, including ties to money and to Wall Street that would probably might work against him if the game is turning out the base. But the real question, there's a couple real questions that remain, right? And one is, what is Hillary Clinton's primary goal in a running mate? Is it someone with a sort of geographic credentials? In other words, is there one state it's all going to come down to, Ohio or Pennsylvania, where she's got to bring a running mate on board who can close the deal in that state, and you know, all fate hinges on that state? Is it that, or is it someone who can go on the stump and attack Trump so that she can focus on the issues? Or is she really not thinking about how a running mate can help her to get elected? Is she more thinking that it won't actually make any difference as long as she chooses well and chooses someone who won't detract? And is her primary goal someone who she would want kind of as her wingman? You know, who does she want to actually govern with?
Don't you think, Margaret, that she really needs to capture the enthusiasm that Bernie Sanders has captured? She needs somebody like Elizabeth Warren or Sherrod Brown, who's not as well known, certainly, but he's a progressive. She needs somebody from that element of the party to get people to go to the polls.
She certainly needs to capture that enthusiasm and translate into votes, but what's not clear to me, and I'm not sure if this is clear to her campaign or not, is whether the only way to capture that enthusiasm is to put that person on the ticket. In other words, if Elizabeth Warren is going to go out there and campaign with all of her heart and soul for Hillary Clinton, go on the stump and say things like, you know, Donald Trump has terrible ideas and his hat is goofy or whatever, right? If that's like her shtick, and if today's debut gives you any sense of what there is to come, does Hillary Clinton need to put her on the ticket? If Elizabeth Warren's going to get out there anyways and whip up the crowds anyways and enthuse the crowds anyway, and if Elizabeth Warren's going to say, you want me in the Senate, you don't want me in the White House, I can serve your purposes better in the Senate, is that enough? You know, who thinks that Joe Biden was the critical reason why Barack Obama got elected in 2008?
Right. No, not at all. And the third thing, I think, was domestic abusers can't have guns. Is that it, Marty?
Yes.
There we go.
Ah. Right.
Yeah. Okay. That was brilliant. Yeah. Thanks so very much. Okay. Now I can go eat my lunch in peace. Thanks.
Thanks, Marty, very much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political you're listening to for this Monday, the 27th of June. And our guest is Margaret Tolliv. She is the senior White House correspondent at Bloomberg and is a board member of the White House Correspondents Association. We're welcoming phone calls on a variety of issues. Our number is 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, phone calls, 800-486-8655 is our number. There was a letter, actually, Margaret, I was reading yesterday when we were talking about vice presidents. Someone said, how about Michael Bloomberg? Sure, he's a billionaire, but look what he's doing with his billions, especially but not only on gun control issues. No doubt many Sanders fans and other members of the Clinton coalition would recoil, but the man has substantial policy chops, an international profile, and an independent streak that combines social progressive with economic conservatism, a perfect new Democrat. Have you grilled him?
I hope you'll forgive me when I say I make it a practice never to speculate on what Mayor Bloomberg might or might not do. Period. I'm going to stop while I'm still ahead.
Okay. All right. Let's go next to Tony in on the road. Hi, Tony.
Hi, this is a gluten-free call, so relax. No problem there. The Sanders campaign, folks who are Sanders supporters, and they're fine people, but if you look at the campaign itself, he did say some things about Hillary that were completely, completely untrue. You know, check the record, Google it, whatever you need to do. Hillary never voted for any of the trade bills. She voted against the Central American trade bill. She didn't vote for the Iraq war. She voted for an authorization. The UN was supposed to be able to complete what they did, but historic record shows, you know, Bush kicked the UN out and said, we're going to start bombing. So it really is important to be careful about all the assertions that were made. As far as the Sanders campaign being ignored, I have never in 50 years watching politics heard of anybody who lost the campaign having anything to do with the platform. And yet Bernie's got the $15 minimum wage, college affordability, all these kinds of issues he talked about are part of the platform.
So no, they're not. They're not part of the platform. They were voted down.
And well, no, they weren't.
Yes, they were Friday.
Well,
they're not in the platform.
On the platform?
No, they're not in the platform. They were not put in the platform.
Everything?
What you just said was not put in the platform.
Okay, which part wasn't part of the platform?
Minimum wage, fracking. The trade agreement.
Well, fracking I'm aware of, but I saw, you know, on lots of reporting that many of those things were, in fact, part of the platform.
No.
The other thing I'd like to say, and most importantly, is remember Nader in 2000, the lesson of history. If you vote for anybody but the two parties, I'm sorry, but that gave us Bush, and that gave us a disaster. And you know, I don't want somebody I can feel good about. I want somebody that can avoid the disaster of Trump.
Okay.
And if that means I have to hold my nose and vote for somebody I'm not really thrilled about, much better than to lose to Donald Trump. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony, for the call. Margaret.
I'm not sure where to start. I think that the platform is an eternal document and much more lasting. Clinton herself recognized the power of the Democratic call for a $15 an hour minimum wage and has said that she does support it in places that can get it done, but that essentially she didn't want to set it as a bar in places where maybe you could get $12 done and $15 would kind of mess up the deal. And so I think a lot of these issues, whether they get included in the platform or not, is not as important as what sort of impact it has in the debate beyond the platform. For people who pay very close attention to conventions and very close attention to party activism, it matters what's in the platform. But for most people who end up voting, who are either swing voters or Democratic voters or independent voters who might vote Democratic, what happens in the debate and what happens in terms of members of Congress being willing to carry legislation to attempt to do something ends up being actually a lot more relevant. I think that Sanders already has had a tremendous impact on the platform and the debate on both fronts. But he has been at a tipping point for a couple of weeks now in terms of what his impact is going to be, not just up until the convention, but after the convention and heading into the fall election and next year. The struggle, what he risks, and the kind of balancing act is, if Hillary Clinton is ultimately elected president, beyond his perch in the Senate, what influence will Bernie Sanders have on the ability to get in her ear or her advisor's ear to talk about issues that are important to him, to help figure out, like, forget about the platform for a second, in terms of if she were actually the president and actually had cabinet secretaries and they were actually crafting policy, you know, can he influence that? And the political reality is that the longer he kind of holds off on full support and full engagement and kind of serves as more of a protest voice, the harder it is ultimately for him. The challenge for her is, right now, how to unify the party and get people motivated to churn out. But if she wins, whether he was with her or not will be something that she and her advisors, you know, remember, and it will shape his ability to have influence on her going forward if she is ultimately elected.
But, Margaret, it's not just his ability. He is, and I think that he means this when he says this, it's not just Bernie Sanders who wants to influence policy. He had millions of young people. I mean, the turnout was phenomenal. Those people
Absolutely.
Aren't going away, and they're going to really ask for the issues that are important to them to be addressed. Now, and it isn't just Bernie who's going to be called on to address them. The people will, unless they drop out of the electoral process completely, but that's not likely to happen, is it?
That's absolutely right. Many of those people are also either Elizabeth Warren fans or
right.
are active in a grassroots group, whether it's Move On or, you know, PCCC or whatever it is. These are people who are actively engaged in promoting progressive or liberal issues. And so their movement does live on and exist not just with Bernie Sanders, but in other kind of offshoots and on other platforms. Forgive my use of the word platform. So I guess what I'm saying is for Sanders himself, it's twofold. It's number one, how do those ideas get a hearing and have an influence? And number two, to what extent can he steer and guide that conversation? And it is that second issue where he's up against a bit of a deadline, right? Because the cause and the issues will find voice in all these other concurrent leaders of that movement. For some Bernie Sanders supporters, it's all about Bernie Sanders, but for more Bernie Sanders, it is about the issues, and he became a voice to mm-hmm. project those issues.
Yeah.
To the extent that he recedes and somebody else steps into that vacuum, he doesn't want to lose control of his ability to shape that discussion and that debate. And I think that that is an issue that exists well beyond kind of the machinations over the platform running up to the convention.
I wanted to ask you this. Should we expect any action this week or next week or any time on a ban on assault weapons and universal background checks after the Orlando massacre and after last week's Democratic House members sit-in?
Boy, they really ran the traps on that, didn't they? And it
yes.
was certainly a poignant and emotive moment, and yet, right, mm-hmm. here we still are. So this is an issue that is not going to be entirely resolved before November, it seems clear to me at this point. And I was going to say, depending on November, we'll see what happens, but I'm not even sure there. When I talk to folks at the White House, they don't seem to feel like, well, now is really the window that we never had before. For the president and the Obama administration, it really always goes back to Newtown, Connecticut, and Sandy Hook. Their ability to do anything in that moment
right.
Made them incredibly pessimistic about the mid to long-term prospects for change.
Bob in Amherst Junction, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Bob.
So I'm calling in response to some of the callers who talked about labor. Because I spent years and years recently in a labor environment, and even the labor organizers in that environment were unable to get people to understand the recent change in Wisconsin to a right-to-work state. The people in labor have been so conflicted. They support the Republican Party like they support the flag, and they don't understand that the Republican Party is anti-labor. They just don't get it. And there's a huge conflict going on right now in labor. So to blame Bloomberg or to blame NPR is not what's going on. I mean, maybe Fox. You know, you could blame Fox, but this is a huge conflict for people right now in this society. They think that in order to be a rural, faithful member of United States flag-waving person, they need to be a Republican. They've abandoned the Democratic Party, and they just don't get it.
All right. Thank you, Bob, very much for the call. We had Thomas Frank on last week, Margaret, and he would argue and did argue in his book that it was the Democratic Party that abandoned labor.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think there's also, again, here two things going on. Certainly changes in the way the economy works and the unionized workforce. That's one sort of set of trends. And the other is there is identity politics around parties that overlays a lot with geography. Do you live in a city or in a major metropolis? Do you live in a rural area? Do you live in the South versus the Northeast? All this stuff does shape people's identity politics and their impression of what each party does and what each party stands for. And certainly you see it coming into play in those Rust Belt states where everybody thinks that this election may very well be decided, Ohio and Pennsylvania in particular.
Yeah. Well, Margaret, thank you very much. Margaret is my favorite female name. It was Aunt Margaret O'Leary's name. I love that name. I'm happy with Kathleen, but I would have preferred Margaret, I think.
Oh, Kathleen's good. You can borrow mine anytime you want.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, Margaret, so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Margaret Tolliv, our guest for All Things Political this hour. She's the senior White House correspondent at Bloomberg, a board member of the White House Correspondents Association, and president of the Washington Press Club Foundation. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to Carrie Salinas for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for help as well, and thanks to all of you for listening. And for calling. We do this every Monday if you're just tuning us in for the first time, every Monday at 1. Of course, this is an election year. We're talking politics a lot. But you can count on Mondays at 1 and All Things Political conversation.